Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. 2019 marked the 80th anniversary of the invasion of Poland by Germany and then a few weeks later, Russia. It was the event that forced Britain and France to finally declare war on Germany. In a five-week campaign, the Wehrmacht fought one of the largest armies in Europe to a point where it collapsed, but the Poles were not necessarily the backward force committing cavalry to attack tanks, as often the narrative of the campaign suggests. In 1939, the Polish army could put more tanks in the field than the US military, and she was exporting arms, including the Bofors gun favoured by the British. Joining me is Robert Forsyk. I've talked to Robert before. We looked at Operation Sea Lion in episode 32, and Case Red, the collapse of France in episode 59. Well, he's back with his new book, Case White, The Invasion of Poland, 1939, from Osprey. Now, this podcast is brought to you by listeners like yourself who enjoy the show and help me find the time to put it together by becoming patrons, by committing to pay a dollar or two each month via Patreon, or even pushing the boat out and committing at a Rockefeller level of support, like listener Jason Pritchett. Thank you for your support, Jason. You can find out more at patreon.com/WW2podcasts. If Patreon is not your thing for whatever reason, but you would like to join the gang, go to www.podcast.com/support and you'll find information on how to support the show via PayPal. In doing so, if you check the box to be added to the mailing list, I will send you links to the extras when I have them. So that's www.podcast.com/support. Bob, it's nice to have you back. I think our starting point is probably the end of the First World War and the formation of Poland. It's a new country, but presumably the Polish military is drawn from a number of traditions. Russian, Prussian. How are the Poles modelling their army? Are they looking forward towards the next war with the opportunity to start from scratch? Or does one of the previous military systems dominate?
Well, it was actually a mix. I mean, at the beginning, so they pulled together different strands from the Austrians, the Russians, some Germans as well. I think they even had a few that came in, expatriates came in from Sweden and Lithuania and other places. But they're pulling together a lot of different people. And then, of course, they don't have any leisure time to build a new army. They're almost immediately attacked by the Russians. So the Russo-Polish War starts, you know, within a year and a half or so of independence. So they're trying to build up an army while being invaded by a major power. And, so that's doubly difficult, is not just create a new army. We look at the armies in Eastern Europe today, you know, as they join NATO, they're trying to revamp their militaries, and they have many years of peace to do that. Poland in 1919 had about 12 to 15 months. Of course, while they're doing this, there's also all sorts of strife in the border areas with not just Russia, but also Germany. There were three separate mini wars in Silesia, and the British Army was actually involved in that, where there were three brigades of British TA troops that were deployed to Silesia, along with two French brigades to basically be a peacekeeping force. And then in what was West Prussia and East Prussia, there's an ongoing conflict there. And then there's a conflict with the Czechs over the Teschen area down south. And then there's a conflict with the Ukrainians over Lvov in the east. So Poland starts out with about five conflicts going on at the same time, followed by a major war with Russia.
It's easy to forget that the First World War doesn't really end in 1918.
From the Germans with the turnip winter, it didn't end until June. And the Allied blockade, most Anglo-Americans are unaware that the blockade was still in effect till June 1919, until they signed the Versailles Treaty. So the turnip winter and turnip spring, the German people were still suffering under blockade 7 months after the guns stopped in Western Europe. But yes, in Poland, it was a chaotic situation where they're trying to pull together an unelected government, put together an army. And of course, Poland had been fought over by both the Germans, Russians, and Austrians in the First World War. So the infrastructure, the railroads, the factories, the cities were all badly knocked about. Agricultural production was very poor. So this is not the kind of fertile ground for building a powerful state, or even, you know, a modern state or a successful one. It was a wrecked state that they inherited right at the beginning.
So when things settled down into the 20s, you know, how is the Polish army organized, funded? Is it well funded? Do they understand that they, do they believe they need a big, strong military, or are they happy to sort of rely on foreign powers sort of saying, you know, you'll be fine, Poland?
Well, I'll work backward from there. As far as the French go, they appreciated the French help during the Russo-Polish War. But Pilsudski, Marshal Pilsudski, who was the leader of Poland, as soon as he could, he wanted to wash his hands of the French, because he realized that the French had other interests in Eastern Europe that did not align with theirs. And the French intent was to create something of a colonial economic trade route. The French were more interested in selling perfume to the Poles than they were tanks or aircraft. And to the French, it was a dumping ground for their economy, post-war economy. And that's what they were interested in setting up, was a trade relationship more than a military relationship. Pilsudski was eventually able to wash his hands of the French and gently tell them to go home, you know, later on during the 20s. But the point you raised there, so in the 20s, unlike the other countries in Western Europe, Poland never had this period after World War I that the British, the French, the Belgians all had, which was, thank God it's over, let's go to peace, you know, let's say no to war again, we're going to have all these treaties and the League of Nations, that'll take care of everything, let's demilitarize. Poland never went through that, because even though they ended up prevailing in all the local conflicts that I mentioned previously, including defeating the Russian invasion, they still recognized they had a knife at their throat. So they said, we really can't demobilize, and we can't adopt this. Poland never had a anti-war movement or pacifist movement as Western Europe did. They couldn't afford to. They needed people to be willing to sign up for the military and defend the borders. But they did recognize they didn't have the funds to support a large military. So as soon as the Russo-Polish War was over, they cut their military back, scaled it back to about 100,000-man army, and reduced as much as they could. But they still had to keep a fairly significant force, and they recognized they had to put money into an air force and a navy and modernization as well. So they were in a bad way for cash. They came up with other methods of raising cash when the government couldn't meet all the needs. So, for example, they had various public subscriptions in Poland where people could – they had like a Navy League and an Air Force League, so people could contribute money to these, and they were essentially popular subscriptions. You saw that stuff in London going on, you know, once the bombs started falling in 1940. But this was – we're talking in the 1920s here. Poland was doing this and raising significant amounts of money for the military. They also became a major arms exporter at a time when this is not very popular. But in the late 1920s and early 30s, they were assisted by the fact that there were a lot of ongoing conflicts in other parts of the world. There was a large market for surplus Great War equipment and weaponry. The Poles had inherited quite a bit of German material and some Russian materials, which they then proceeded to export to China, the Balkans, Spain later on in the 1930s, but various places around the world, Latin America as well. So that was able to bring them some revenue in. And I think the Poles made a lot of mistakes, but they made some good calls with their money that they did get. They invested in strategic industries. They developed a very close relationship with Bofors in Sweden, which led to them getting the patents for the 37-millimeter anti-tank gun and the 40-millimeter anti-aircraft gun. That's the famous World War II anti-aircraft gun that was used by Britain, the United States, and so many other countries, the 40-millimeter. Poland had that weapon, and they were producing it in the mid-1930s. And so they did invest wisely in some of the weapons they chose. They, like all the other countries in Central Europe, they had a problem with aircraft engines in that it was very hard to come up with a good engine. So even though they had a design, they created an aircraft design bureau. They wanted to build fighters and bombers. They were able to come up with the designs, but coming up with an appropriate engine was not so easy. So they were able to get some engines from Britain, some French engines. They weren't some of the better quality engines out there. The American engines were too expensive, and they weren't interested in Russian engines. That was one of the reasons the Air Force going into World War II had a weakness there, and you know, they lacked a modern fighter, is because they lacked access to modern aircraft engines until very late in the day.
Was that a conscious effort Was that, you know, a conscious thing from Britain and France not to supply them military planes, or was it they just didn't have the capital to purchase them?
Well, I'll split those into two parts. So the French did sell a lot of aircraft to Poland starting in the 1920s and then the 1930s. The deals were generally not advantageous to Poland. They were usually very expensive, and they were inferior designs. The French at the time were trying to keep their aircraft industry afloat. They were developing a lot of new designs that were essentially slightly modified Great War aircraft, really of no improved performance. They dumped a lot of these aircraft on Poland, which held them back. Britain did not sell many aircraft at all. In fact, the amount of weapons that were sold by Britain to Poland between 1919 and 1939 would pretty much fit in one small freighter.
Is that because we were just holding everything for ourselves, presumably?
Well, so on the British side, okay, part of it is British relations with Poland were not good up until Chamberlain's commitment to Poland in April 1939. The British position, particularly taken by Lloyd George and his group in Parliament, was that Poland had stolen land from Germany. Poland was causing a lot of problems in Eastern Europe. Pilsudski was not in favor. An individual named Napier, who was a former Polish citizen of Jewish ethnicity, who now worked in Britain as the in the Foreign Office, labeled Poland as an anti-Semitic power. So the foreign ministry in Britain generally took a dim view of Polish policies. So all of this led to not very good relations. The trade relationship between Britain and Poland was very poor. Britain was more interested in developing trade with Germany, post-war Germany. Germany looked like a very good market. Poland looked like a very poor market. And nowadays, I think a lot of English people forget how much was invested in by Britain in China. There was much more interest in supporting Chiang Kai-shek than there was in supporting Poland. China was a moneymaker. And there's great capital to be made in Shanghai and Hong Kong and places of that sort. Poland barely had a port. It had very little export other than a little bit of coal. And once we moved closer to the actual threat of German aggression, Britain started to change its attitude a bit. But as I detail in the book, the whole effort to get a squadron of Hurricane fighters to Poland before the German invasion was badly mismanaged and a very half-hearted effort. And in the long run, who ended up getting those 12 hurricanes? It was Turkey. Yeah. Meanwhile, it amazes me, Britain was quite willing to give a squadron of hurricane fighters to Portugal and a squadron to Belgium at the same time, where there was no strategic interest, really. So I think at that point you could say that the British military sales were decoupled from strategic thinking. The Committee on Imperial Defense was mostly focused on just that, on imperial defense. And when it came to strategic issues like what country should we support in Europe that might, you know, help deter German aggression, I don't think there was a real coordination going on between the foreign ministry, the ministry of the treasury, which objected to most arms sales unless there was profit to be had. Like in the case of Portugal, of course, being a longtime British ally going back centuries, selling weapons to Portugal made sense to the treasury because there are trade treaties attached to it.
It's a convenient stop for the fleet as well on the way to India.
Yes, there are many advantages. And the Americans did pretty much the same thing. You know, the Americans, the Poles approached the Americans for arms sales, and essentially the, you know, American aircraft were just too expensive. They couldn't afford them. And the delivery times, of course, moving into the war, both Britain and France ordered large amounts of British American aircraft, and they were very slow to show up. And of course, many of them turned out to be a disappointment as it was. That's where most of the Desert Air Force came from, was surplus American junk that was sold, the P-40 Kitty Hawks and stuff that were great designs in 1939, but aged quickly.
Well, yes, as a lot of planes of those in the 1930s seem to age remarkably fast. So Hitler comes to power, and he's always been clear about Lebensraum, you know, about wanting land in the east. Did the Poles take Hitler serious? Were they looking at that western border and building static defences and preparing for a potential attack by the Germans?
No, not until late in the day. From the point of view of Warsaw, the main threat was always in the east. It was Stalin, and it was a consistent threat. And I have one table in the book where I show how the threat ramped up very quickly from about 1936 on. And I think that's not appreciated today, that the German threat, yes, Hitler talked about Lebensraum, and it was, you know, looking backwards, it's pretty obvious that he was had aggressive intent from the very beginning. But at the time period, as late as 1933, 34, Germany's military capability was less than Poland's. So they were not a serious threat in the first few years. And Hitler, if you recall, did not really make any overtly aggressive moves for the first couple of years. He was doing things internally in Germany to, you know, solidify his regime and eliminate enemies. But he was relatively cautious until he moved against Austria. He recognized that as soon as he started, and the Ruhr, of course, in 36, but he was very cautious. You know, the Ruhr was a big toe put in the water to see what the temperature was. And when he saw no reaction, he realized he could do a little bit more. But from the Polish point of view, Hitler didn't become a serious threat until late in the day, until Munich, really, in 38. And all of a sudden, they realized the Luftwaffe pretty much tripled in strength in about a one-year time period. In fact, I hope to do in a future book, I hope to look more about how the Germans actually managed to do that, because it's pretty amazing how they were able to increase from virtually a cardboard air force of a handful of aircraft to bigger than the RAF and the French Air Force combined in about an 18-month period. It caught the British and French by surprise, too. Nobody figured that he could do that. It's just amazing. You know, BF-109 fighter was probably the key weapon, and they were able to put it into serial production very rapidly and crank out, I think, 500 or 600 in the course of a year. I'm sure you're aware the production numbers for Spitfire and Hurricane at that point were much, much lower. So it was, I think at the start of war, you had maybe 2 or 3 Spitfire squadrons, and the Germans had already fielded about something like 15 squadrons or more of BF-109E, which is their latest model. And so, I mean, that caught everyone by surprise. Not that it did them that much good over Poland. As I mentioned in the book, very few people are aware that the BF-109E had the same problem over Poland that it had over London later, limited range. And the first time they tried to fly a squadron of BF-109E fighters over Warsaw, they made it to Warsaw, but on the way back, they all ran out of fuel. They hadn't thought it through, you know. And what's more amazing, this was September 1939. They had a full year to get ready for Eagle Day over London to maybe, you know, get some longer range here, build extra fuel tanks or something. And but obviously that didn't go into the lessons learned category.
So if we look at that that build-up for the German build-up of the invasion of Poland, was it in complete secrecy? How much were the Poles aware of something being afoot, or did they choose not to be aware?
Strategically, they were caught pretty much by surprise, and which is funny because they had broken the Enigma codes prior to the war. A lot of this research is still needs to be done. We don't know exactly what Polish intelligence could read and couldn't read. You know, the Allies at this point had no access to the German Enigma codes, but the The polls we know were reading some of it. It's not clear how much. I think they had some idea that something was up, and clearly German rhetoric was not hiding the fact that they were gearing up towards, you know, trouble. And the German ambassador had already been recalled. But the Germans, I think, were fairly successful, and most observers in Poland and elsewhere expected Hitler to make a local move just against Danzig. And that was the expectation, not all-out war, but a limited attack to seize Danzig and call it a day.
So seize that corridor, which would have taken the Polish corridor, which would have connected to Danzig, and Danzig connects to
East Prussia.
Prussia.
So I think that was the expectation, and the Poles had deployed to deal with that threat of a limited war. And I think that's what they were expecting. I think that's what Chamberlain and the French were expecting, was perhaps a limited attack to seize a discrete piece of land and then stop and try and negotiate. Of course, that's the aggressor's fantasy. The same thing with Saddam Hussein in Kuwait in 1990. There's always this idea aggressors have that they can attack, take a little bit of a war, and then stop as soon as they're ahead and negotiate. And, you know, the losers are just supposed to accept it. And, yeah, that usually doesn't work out that way.
Well, it's amazing that, you know, I mean, it's 400,000 Germans mobilize and pass it off as summer maneuvers, and the Poles somehow either accept it or weren't too troubled by it. It's a remarkable feat on the part of the Germans.
You know, the Poles didn't have a lot of means to. The Germans were flying reconnaissance planes over Poland, but the Poles were not flying reconnaissance planes over Germany. The borders were starting to close up a bit before the war even got going. So it became more difficult for people to go across the border and observe what was going on. A lot of the German reservists did not know they were going to war until the day before. They thought they were on summer maneuvers. And I made the point in the book that the German naval commando unit that was landed at Westerplatte, near Danzig there, the military warehouse that held out for 8 days, that this is a special forces unit, essentially. Naval commandos was landed on the battleship, and, you know, they snuck into the port. They only had training hand grenades. This is a special forces unit that's playing a key role, and they think they're in an exercise too.
So on that first day, the first units to go in, is it the Luftwaffe? Are they the first over the border? Presumably aiming to knock the Polish Air Force out on the ground, which is sort of part of the perceived narrative.
Well, that's the standard story. And my book spends a lot of effort arguing against the standard historiography, the standard historical narrative, which I maintain is based mostly on, you know, a combination of propaganda, mostly Axis propaganda.
The winners wrote the history.
Well, you know, because the Anglo-Americans and French weren't directly involved, there was not much of an incentive to go rewrite it. A lot of German accounts, like the famous cavalry charging tank thing, which was written by an Italian journalist at the time, was never really seriously examined. I'm not the first one to point this out. I mean, others have as well. I mentioned Steve Zaloga in my book. You know, he's done his book on Poland, mentioned it. There have been a few others. But unfortunately, a lot of these wartime exaggerations or distortions have stayed. The same thing with the, you know, there's several big ones. One is the Polish army was ill-equipped. Well, as I point out, without recovering the ground I just stated, very few people are aware that Poland was exporting weapons to Britain. Britain was not exporting weapons to, you know. So if you ever go back and look at photos of Dunkirk, there's 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns along the beach there. I believe those were from Poland, because Britain did not get a license to produce 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns until after Dunkirk, and they had very few of them. So I think they were sent along with the BEF. The same thing with the 37-millimeter anti-tank guns. I mean, it was state-of-the-art in 1939, and you know, Poland was producing it, but they were exporting it to Britain and France, who were having troubles. The 2-pounder anti-tank gun program in England was behind schedule, so they imported anti-tank guns from Poland, obviously leaving less for the Polish army. But so the outdated equipment, outdated doctrine argument has been left along for too long. Poland was as well equipped as the French or British were in 1939. I mean, the BEF had no gun-armed tanks when they first landed in France. The first A-10 cruiser tanks didn't show up till late May 1940. And the Poles had over 100 gun-armed tanks. So their army was relatively well-equipped by 1939 standards. And as far as the doctrine, their doctrine was no worse than what the Allies employed against the Germans in 1940. The problem is they were more badly outnumbered. At least the Anglo-French had about a 1-to-1 or a slight edge in numbers, whereas the Poles were outnumbered 2-to-1. In that sense, with the, you know, their doctrine made less difference than the fact that they were badly outnumbered.
Well, presumably as well, they have a problem mobilizing. I'm assuming that there's a lot of irregular territorial troops. What did the Polish army call part-time
reservists?
Reservists.
Yeah, the French call them A and B schedule reservists. The Poles, I think, had three categories, you know, basically for the younger reservists, the older reservists, and then the really old guys with no training at all or completely untrained people.
But presumably, the swiftness of the attack, if they've not mobilized pre the attack, there's a period where they've got to mobilize these reservists, which takes...
Well, it was difficult because a lot of their units were coming from all over Poland. Now, Poland started a secret mobilization, partial mobilization, when Hitler took Memel, the port of Memel in Lithuania. He seized that about the same time he took the rest of the Czech state, Prague. He marched into the city of Memel, occupied it. At that point, the Poles realized we're in trouble, that this is serious. The Germans are using armed force to take territory. So they began a partial mobilization. That added four divisions out of a potential 30, and their peacetime army was about 10 divisions, not full strength. So after the partial mobilization, they had about a dozen or so more or less complete divisions, still not totally complete. As time marched on during the summer of 1939, I think they had a total of three more partial mobilizations. Each time they would call up a different set of reservists. Now, the problem is this is very expensive. You know, this is a problem that Israel runs into all the time because they have a reserve-based military system. If you call up and the crisis goes on for a long time, it costs you a lot of money. These people are not working their civilian jobs, so there's another cost there. So it's not that they were reluctant to mobilize, but they realized they could only get away with mobilizing so much without breaking their economy. And in fact, when they asked Britain for a loan in the summer of 1939 after Chamberlain's guarantee, that was one of the things they wanted money for, was to help pay their reservists so they could stay in service longer, so they could keep them around till at least the end of the summer. Now, at the last second, just before the German attack, they did a frantic general mobilization, and that was pretty much a failure because that was intended to increase the army from about 300,000 or 400,000 up to about 1 million potentially. Based on the numbers we have now, we know that the Poles were able to field maybe 750,000 troops during the campaign. A lot of reservists were scooped up at the very end of the war, captured by the Russians in their mobilization stations, still without weapons, some without uniforms. So the general mobilization was a failure. The Anglo-French at the last minute before the German attack cautioned Poland not to announce general mobilization, you know, keeping 1914 in mind. That was a complete misread of Hitler, of course, because he didn't care whether general mobilization was called or not. So the mobilization did not go terribly well. Another one of the incorrect views about the campaign that I spend time talking about is the role of the Polish Air Force, which, you know, is always... You know, many accounts, even accounts by John Keegan, I mentioned, and Max Hastings mentioned that the Polish Air Force was destroyed on the ground in the first day or two, which is totally untrue. I mean, the data is there. The information is very complete and accurate on how many sorties the Polish Air Force was flying. They dispersed just before the German attack. The Germans hit mostly empty airfields. They destroyed some trainer aircraft. The Polish Air Force essentially was useful for about 7 days. After that, they dispersed further and they lost all effectiveness because they were bouncing around between secondary, tertiary airfields. They didn't have the supports, ground support staff, the fuel trucks, all of the ancillary equipment which lets a modern Air Force function. So the aircraft survived, and most of them eventually were flown to Romania. And virtually the entire Polish Air Force survived the campaign. As I point out, the senior commander, several of the senior commanders, the two top Polish aces from the 1939 campaign, both went on to fly for the RAF.
Yeah. Well, I made a book. There's 67 Me-109s lost for 52 victories, which isn't great. But, you know, and of those 67, 43% of the losses are due to Poles. So they are fighting back, which, again, is not part of the regular narrative of you get that they've basically written out of it as the Polish Air Force.
Yeah, I mean, that's just – it was easy because the Luftwaffe, of course, always wanted to say, well, don't forget, according to the Luftwaffe, the RAF was beaten in August 1942. So if you take that as your source, well, then the Luftwaffe did better in every campaign it fought. You know, the truth of the matter is the – Polish Air Force, you know, basically they were able to resist for about a week. Their losses were heavy, which, you know, quickly, like any small air force, it could only stay in operation for so long. But the bulk of their pilots and crew survived, and a lot of these experienced pilots would, you know, help with the Battle of Britain a year later. So, I mean, the whole German effort to destroy the, you know, the Polish Air Force on the ground is not only a myth, but it was a complete failure. And it didn't work against the Poles. It didn't work even against the French, and it didn't work against the British. So, I mean, the only air force that ever really worked against to some extent was the Soviets, who were, you know, caught very much by surprise and didn't disperse ahead of time. But of course, even the Soviet air force recovered.
So another one of those things that comes up in the regular narrative, you know, the Germans, you know, such as with people like Guderian leading the charge, sort of romp through in this sort of blitzkrieg, spearheading things, running rings around everyone. I wonder if that sort of headline statement about the sort of campaign, that's the sort of the easy view of the camp. I wonder if that masks deficiencies within the German army that we never hear about during the Polish campaign.
Well, yes. I mean, if you notice, I studiously avoid the use of the word blitzkrieg throughout the entire book. I think I only used the word once in the entire book, and that was to mention somebody else mentioning the term. But I'm trying to distance myself from that. And it was a propaganda term that the Axis, I believe Italian actually coined the phrase, but it was a propaganda phrase that they liked to repeat because it made it sound like they were invincible. Blitz, you know, we're going to blitz through you. But as I point out, that the Wehrmacht in 1939 was very much a beta version of an improved military. For the most part, you had a small mechanized element, much smaller in 1939 than it was in the later campaigns, really about 6 or 7 mechanized motorized divisions. The rest of the force, the other 40 or 50 divisions, were all basically very similar to 1918-style German infantry divisions, horse-drawn artillery, troops marching on foot. So this was a small, modernized spear point leading basically a World War I-style force. And a lot of the basic issues with air support that they were so good at later in the war, they were still working out. And, you know, so German air support, you read in the book it several times, you know, the Germans getting held up by Polish fortifications here, defenses there, and you're wondering, where is the Luftwaffe in all this? I mean, if this had happened in 1941, the Luftwaffe would be right in on this with the Stukas dive bombing and taking these positions out. Most people are not aware that the Stukas were not used in close air support role in Poland. That's a common misconception. One of the reasons is that the army didn't trust the Luftwaffe to not bomb their own troops. They really hadn't worked out the procedures yet. So the Stukas were generally told to go bomb railroad stations and targets on the lines of communications 20 or 30 miles behind the line where there was no doubt this is an enemy target. What you didn't see in Poland was Stukas attacking enemy positions right in front of German units because they knew that was not going to go well. They figured there'd be a lot of accidents. It's the beginning of a war. There's a lot of confusion. People are not veterans yet. So they they avoided that in 1939. That kind of, but you have this image of Stukas, and you always think, well, their Stukas are bombing right in front of the Panzers and everything, and it just didn't work out that way. They were usually attacking railroad stations, was fixed targets.
I sort of got off the feeling that the Germans have got all the pieces of the jigsaw. They just don't know how to put it together. So, you know, you get Guderian at one point runs out of fuel. It almost seems, almost a bit, Laurel Hardy is too harsh. But, you know, they're trying to figure out how it works.
I point out in the book that, you know, and I even have a photo in there of one of the training sessions they had in Germany prior to the war. And to me, it amazes me how sterile the photo is. You have some tanks and some infantry firing on a range. This is not what actual war looks like. And the Germans, so when they get in, all of a sudden they're doing an urban assault into Warsaw. Well, that didn't look anything like Grafenwehr, the training range at Grafenwehr. All of a sudden you have an urban center with buildings and snipers up in, you know, rooftops and things of that sort. The Germans had trained heavily, probably more than any of the other armies, but they had not trained in realistic environments. And things like logistics, when you're on a military base or training range, you're not moving very far. So they found that supplying tanks, keeping them refueled on German soil, on their own military facilities, was not too difficult. All of a sudden they go into Poland, and it always amazes me. You read all the German accounts, and they keep complaining throughout how bad the Polish roads were and how this messed up their logistics and their trucks had difficulty. And, of course, you realize the roads in Poland were a lot better than the roads in Russia. there were more of them and they were better, and some of them were paved. But to me, that's an indication of how poorly prepared they were to fight a real mobile campaign in realistic terrain. They hadn't planned to move hundreds of kilometers very rapidly and supply the people at the front. And it had never been done before.
So something else that struck me about that, I think almost everyone expected the war, a new war, to work, you know, faster than the First World War, but still they're thinking in terms of First World War movements. So the British and the French reactions are just slow on every account. You know, it takes them 3 days to declare war. It takes them over nearly 2 weeks for the general British and French general staffs to sit down and come up with a plan. There's only another 3 weeks left of the whole campaign.
Yes. Well, you know, the British general staff expected Poland to hold out several months. But even if they'd had more time, there was no real plan to do anything. Unfortunately, that's another point I made in the book, is that both the French and the British guarantees to Poland were insincere. There was, even granted more time, if the Germans had not immediately attacked Poland or if the crisis had dragged on a little longer, there was no intent to send any serious aid to Poland, nor was there any serious intent to attack Germany on the Western Front, even with aircraft. I mean, the RAF had gone through all this effort to develop a bombing plan for the Ruhr, and then attack German industry in the Ruhr. And then as soon as the war got going, they said, well, you know, the Chamberlain administration said we don't want to execute it. And the RAF, of course, did not begin serious bombing of German targets until Britain itself was bombed. And the French were actually leaning a little bit more towards bombing Germany, because I think the French recognized that it was only a matter of time until German bombs started falling on France. So they were a little more willing, but they, you know, when the RAF said they would not conduct a campaign against the Ruhr, that was, you know, the French instead just did a gesture offensive in the Saar that lasted a few days and accomplished nothing.
If we look at the German troops, the Germans, you know, did they ever come up unstuck when they met organized, regular Polish troops, or are the Poles just completely outclassed?
Oh, no, I mentioned several occasions where particularly the SS, the Waffen-SS units, you know, of course, they're nowadays, the Waffen-SS are kind of a cult sort of fascination for people interested in history. I tend to make it my business to try and deflate the Waffen-SS whenever I can. It is a fact that their performance in Poland was very poor on the battlefield and beyond the battlefield. Waffen-SS only had essentially two regimental-sized groups operating, one in the northern part of Poland and one in the other southern part. Both of them were performed very poorly in combat. The group in the south was ambushed by the Poles and shot up pretty badly, lost its commander, was killed. But the regiment operating under the north, von Bock, the German army group commander in the north, he tried to court-martial a number of the SS officers and personnel for a variety of war crimes and military misdemeanors. A lot of the SS troops were more interested in abusing the civilians and looting than they were in fighting. And so von Bock was not, he was a, you know, old prim and proper kind of commander, did not like that kind of thing, and tried to court-martial him. It went all the way up the chain. This is probably the only time in World War II this happened, that an army commander tried to court-martial SS soldiers, and went all the way up, and Himmler was able to squash the charges so they weren't court-martialed, and they tried to make sure after that that SS units were not put under army command. And this started a seed of an issue in the German, in the Wehrmacht, that the SS from that point on was always trying to disassociate itself and get out from under command of the army, so they could kind of do their own thing. But there were other instances as well. Several German units did not perform particularly well. One of the things you won't see in all the Blitzkrieg mythology, it's kind of amazing actually, is how many police units the Germans used in the front line during Case Y, as well as Landwehr, which are, these are kind of second line TA troops. These are the old guys. So you have Landwehr and police being used as frontline units during the campaign, which to me indicates that the Germans were hard stretched to maintain some kind of front in the west along the Westfall and invade Poland. And they were forced to use a lot of units that they would never use in later campaigns. And by the time the French campaign rolled around in 1940, the Wehrmacht had grown enough that they didn't have to use these kind of units in the front line, but they used them instead for occupation duties of that sort. But it's rather bizarre that you see some of these police formations being used in an attack role, and they perform poorly when up against regular troops, which is not surprising.
Did the Poles ever come close to stopping the German advance?
No, not really. I mean, the Poles made a number of operational mistakes, which sort of snowballed, basically bad deployment from the beginning. Then they decided to retreat. It was sort of a headlong retreat. Most armies do not retreat very well. It's a skill that you, a veteran force might be able to pull off. But retreating is very difficult, especially if you're under attack while it's happening. So their army began to disintegrate, and so they were not able to stop. Now, the one counterattack, the Battle of the Bizerte River, was a different situation. The Germans, you know, they had their own issues, and one of them was they managed to lose track of one entire Polish army during the campaign. In fact, if you go look at the German situation maps, it's amazing. The army Poznan, which was deployed in southwest Poland, they had not deployed any German force to attack them. It was simply just felt, we'll surround this force with our great pincers and we'll mop them up later. But you had a substantial Polish force of almost 100,000 troops, six complete divisions that were just disappeared off the situation maps. And it was the beginning of the war. The Germans were still making amateur mistakes. The Poles didn't do anything fancy. They just started marching back towards Warsaw on foot. And they managed to arrive west of Poland just as the Germans were converging on the city. And they launched a major counterattack, the Battle of the Bizerte, which caught the Germans completely by surprise. And they were able to rough up one German infantry division fairly badly and put several other divisions on in a defensive mode. So the Germans were forced to react. It's one of the reasons that Warsaw did not fall quickly, is just as the siege of Warsaw was beginning, the Germans had to reorient to deal with this threat behind them. What's more, even more amazing is that, you know, most accounts will tell you that all the Polish forces involved in the Bizerte were eventually encircled and destroyed. And yet in reality, almost 50,000 of them made it to Warsaw. You know, later in the war in Russia, we see the Germans become expert in these pocket battles where they're able to surround large forces and wipe them out quickly. That did not happen in Poland. For a variety of reasons, the Germans were able to cut off or encircle Polish units, but they often didn't finish them off, and they escaped on many occasions. And that's, again, it's they got better at it as it was going on, but they were definitely still not the, you know, the invincible force or faultless force that you see suggested by German propaganda later in the war.
The Poles have a sizable amount of men in Warsaw. Why is it not another, obviously another Stalingrad, but why is it not another large urban battle where they could have, I mean, I know that one anti-tank gun knocks out seven German tanks in Warsaw. Whilst that might not have ultimately changed the result of things, it could have given them a serious bloody nose, made them think twice or bought the Poles more time.
Well, essentially that's what happened. The Germans made two small attempts at the beginning to try and fight their way into the city, and both attempts were repulsed. They found out that panzer divisions don't work very well in cities, and which is one of the reasons they didn't want to use panzer divisions against cities like Paris later on. But when they were repulsed, the Poles essentially fortified the city and dug in, and the city was able to hold out. The Germans at that point had no stomach for further city fighting, so they opted for a siege. And then the Luftwaffe came in and proceeded to bomb the city and set it on fire. What essentially doomed the garrison of Poland, they had over 100,000 troops in Warsaw by the end of the siege, which was a significant amount. And they actually had a few ammunition factories to produce more ammunition. But the food situation was not terrible. It was getting bad. But what really did it was the Germans were able to knock out the water plants. So the Poles are no longer able to extinguish fires caused by air raids, and the civilian casualties were mounting rapidly. It's unknown how many Polish civilians were killed in Warsaw by Luftwaffe attacks. Clearly, it was in the thousands. The numbers on this are difficult to gauge, but at that point, the Poles decided after several weeks of resistance that there was no point of further resistance, that all that was going to happen was more Polish civilians dying for no military gain.
And by that point, Russia's also invaded, which presumably is the last nail in the coffin.
Well, exactly. If Britain and France had been doing something, Warsaw might have held out a little longer. But with the Russians coming in and no sign of action from the West, there was really nothing to be gained further at that point.
Do you think standing at the start line, in on the 1st of September, it was a foregone conclusion?
With the cards that Poland held in its hand, there was no way they could have won, especially with Russia coming in. If somehow Russia could have been deterred from coming in, perhaps if Britain and France had said something to Stalin, probably wouldn't have had any more effect than it did on Hitler. But if somehow Russia had stayed out of it, I think Poland might have lasted a bit longer. I mean, basically the strategy was hold Warsaw and the bulk of the army and air force withdraw to the Romanian border area, which was very mountainous. And the Germans never did overrun that area. The Russians eventually moved in. But I think Polish forces could have held out in the Galician mountains for a few extra weeks, perhaps a month at tops. That might have meant more Polish troops escaping to the West in the long run. You know, the war was essentially lost. You know, the campaign was essentially lost before the first shot was fired, I believe.
It's fascinating because it is very much a proto campaign for France, where nothing quite works how you think it does. It just gets glossed over, does the Polish campaign. But one of the things that, you know, one final question, really, there is a lot of troops escape. He has 10,000 airmen, 23,000 army. Now they're sandwiched in is Poland between Germany. How did these men get out? Which is something I've never quite ever got to the bottom of.
Well, Romania at that point was not an Axis ally, and so that didn't come until later. And in fact, none of the Balkan countries were Axis allies at this point. Hungary and Romania were not allied. In fact, you may not be aware of this, but Romania was selling oil to Britain from the Ploiești oil field until May 1940. These were still neutral countries. Britain still had economic trade through the Mediterranean. Italy didn't go to war till June 1940. So Britain still had trade with the Romanians, and they still had diplomatic interests there. But the French were able to help a bit. The French military mission left Poland, went into Romania, and helped set up basically an escape corridor. There's a lot of interesting accounts by Polish officers, for example. You'll read about they crossed the border. They reported to the French embassy, or the Polish embassy was quickly shut down. They'd report to the French embassy. The French military officer would give them a train ticket from Romania through Yugoslavia to Italy and then to France. And they literally would just take the train. So, you know, it was an extended, maybe 2-day train ride through Milan. It wasn't, you know, dig a tunnel and, you know, escape, you know, Stalag 17 or something. It was,
trains must have been packed with Polish servicemen.
Yes. And it continued, actually. So the 23,000 and the 10,000 number, that's right then, but the trickle continued afterwards, until for about another 6 months. So you had additional personnel sneaking out across the border, over during the course of the winter. And, you know, the Germans, of course, were very chagrined to see this activity going on, but they were hoping to get Romania as an ally. So they did not want to do anything on Romanian soil. At this point, they didn't want to do that heavy-handed Gestapo kind of thing that they probably would have done later in the war, which is like stop the trains and probably take every Polish soldier off. But at this point, they didn't want to violate Romanian sovereignty. They wanted their oil. And I think also at this point, the Germans just had the arrogant attitude that the Poles are out of it. It doesn't matter if they escape or not. It just doesn't matter.
Well, with the remnants of the Polish army escaping to fight another day, that seems like a good place to end. Thanks, Bob. As ever, it was great to chat. Loyal listener, if you want to know more about the invasion of Poland, the book is Case White, The Invasion of Poland, 1939. I will put a link on the website, www.podcast.com. Well, that's all for this episode. Next time we'll be back, sort of in the Ardennes, really, with Mark Felton. But until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.